You're listening to Critical Reads. This show is designed to help people critically analyze topics like race, culture, and faith, one resource at a time. I am your host, Neff Lesperance. Hi, everybody, and welcome to another exciting episode of Critical Reads, the podcast. I'm your host, Neff, as it says in the intro. Thank you so much for those of you who are returning for this third episode. And for those of you where this is your first episode, as always, welcome. So on today's episode, we are going to dive into a book entitled Godspace. And soon I will dive into more about why I chose this book, what it's about, the author, et cetera, like always. But before we get into the book, I wanted to hop into my segment again that I'm calling Musings of a Tired Black Social Worker. And I did say that I wasn't sure if I was going to stick to the name, but so far, I'm liking it. So as always, I will explain the segment. And basically, this segment is something that I just wanted to use to kind of reflect on something that was interesting, that caught my attention or was on my mind during the week. And sometimes, you know, it could be something that I saw on Facebook, on Instagram, one of the social media. Sometimes it could be from a conversation that I was having with a friend or a colleague that really stuck with me. And so I will use a little bit of the time that we have together just to kind of reflect on some things, because not only do I want to show you guys how I'm deconstructing or like critically thinking through things through these books, but also I want to show you how I'm doing that in my day-to-day life and all the things that I'm seeing and hearing. So with today's segment, Musings of a Tired Black Social Worker, today I wanted to kind of reflect on this idea of empathy is a sin. And I don't know, I'm not necessarily making this a Christian podcast. I do happen to be a person that's a Christian. And, you know, of course, I'm still working through what my identity and that looks like. And so I know I will be talking about Christianity and theology a lot, but I hope that's not something that will deter you from listening, because again, this is not a Christian podcast, but I'm a podcaster that happens to be a Christian. And so I do recognize that a lot of the things or the books that I bring up might start from that place. But as I'm deconstructing and as I'm learning and bringing up other things, we will cover topics and books and different things that are not so Christianly focused, so to speak. But the reason I brought up this topic, empathy is a sin, is because I was just noticing, because there are a lot of millennials and younger generation and even people above us who are like unpacking the traumas that have happened to them within the church or because of the church. Some of the church leaders, a lot of them have been white males, have had the time to write articles kind of talking about how empathy can be seen as a sin. And so for me, being the theology nerd that I am and the reader that I am, I found that idea intriguing. And I think, obviously, at first, my initial reaction was, this is a load of shit. So I didn't really want to engage in it. But of course, being the person that I am, I still took the time to read a little bit about what the arguments were for this. And I still think this is a load of shit, but at least I am thankful that I took the time to actually read what was said before I made my opinion like official, right? And again, that's what I want you all to do when you are presented with these things. And so just one more important thing I want to note before we dive deeper into these arguments is, for me, when I think of white people or whiteness, I kind of adopt this idea that I've heard from multiple people, including Amanda Seales and some of the activists and organizers I follow. I think when we talk about white people and whiteness, I see that in two categories. White people, and those are people that are like heavily tied to white supremacy, They love everything about it. They don't want to change it. They're challenging critical race theory. They're angry at BLM. Anytime somebody black or brown stands up for themselves, they're upset. That's that category. They're happy about, you know, the Confederate flag. They're happy about trying to preserve history. Some of y'all are now also happy with what happened with Kyle. That's white people. But then the other category is people who happen to be white. And for me, if you're a person that happens to be white, you are doing the internal work. You're recognizing that white supremacy is something that's real. Colonialism is something that has happened. You're trying to do the internal work that you can do to use your power and your privilege to challenge these systems of oppression. Whether that means, you know, having the hard conversations with other people that are white around you, whether that means, you know, changing the way that you do business or the way that you work so that you can be more inclusive. At the end of the day, if you're a person that happens to be white, there's some level of lament that's happening in your life. There's some level of learning and growing that you're trying to do in your life. And we see you. We appreciate you. We wish there were more of you. But again, these are the two categories. And so today, this is mostly addressing some of the thoughts of people that are white people that are proud of white supremacy and are not trying to change anything. So I want to clarify that because as I talk about this, I know there might be a little bit of dragging. And I just want you to know it's not that I'm dragging all white people because I know there are white people that are not subscribing to this bullshit. But there's still enough of you out there that this is a problem. So with that said, so this idea of empathy as a sin basically was presented, I think, in 2019 on the Desiring God website. It was written by this guy named Joe Rigney, who succeeded John Piper, who's another big dude in the evangelical church, as the president of Bethlehem College and Seminary. And he basically wrote a post about this and borrowed from C.S. Lewis the Screwtape's letters, you know, and so he kind of drafted his own version of Dear Wormwood. He used that format to kind of warn about the dangers of empathy. And I guess this guy also serves as a pastor of City's Church in the Twin Cities that's also kind of affiliated with Piper's Bethlehem Baptist Church in Minneapolis. So in writing to this imaginary friend Wormwood, Wrigley kind of advises the following. He says, by elevating empathy over compassion as the superior virtue, this is now an entire culture devoted to the total immersion of empathy. Books, articles, and social media all value the importance of checking one's own beliefs, values, and judgments and reason at the door of empathy. And so, first, there's a lot there to unpack. But then just to kind of go over some of his ideas of what's wrong with empathy, he says the following. So one of the dangers of empathy is that it pulls a Christian down to the pit of sin along with a person in need. His assumption is that empathy, unlike sympathy, requires acquiescence to any and all beliefs, including those that counter the Christian faith. Rightly used, empathy is a power tool in the hands of the weak and suffering. By it, we can so weaponize victims that they and those who hide behind them are indulged at every turn without regard for whether such indulgence is wise or prudent or good for them. So basically, in short, this man thinks empathy is a sin. And then I know later on he went on a podcast and he was interviewed by this guy named Doug Wilson, who's a pastor of another church in Idaho. And he illustrates the problem with empathy by saying the following. Empathy is the sort of thing that you've got someone drowning or they're in quicksand and they're sinking. And what empathy wants you to do is to jump in the quicksand with them, both feet, and it feels like that's going to be more loving because they're going to feel like, I'm glad you're here with me in the quicksand. The problem is, both of you are now sinning. Sympathy, on the other hand, stays safely on dry land. And then he kind of states that the rescuer then is able to say, I'm going to keep one foot on the shore and I'm actually going to grab onto this big branch and then I'll hope, and then I'll step one foot in there with you and try to pull you out. That's sympathy. And that's actually helpful. But to the person who is in there, it can feel like you're judging me. From there, the podcast host kind of mentioned or notes that essentially that necessity kind of creates kind of a hierarchy. And then so Wrigley replies by saying, right, it implies that one person is hurting and one person is the helper. And that's the problem. No one wants to feel like they're hurting. We want to equalize everything. And so empathy demands, get in here with me. Otherwise, you don't love me. So obviously, you know, what I'm sharing right now in this podcast is only a small part of a larger conversation. So as always, as I do with my content, I will be posting notes or links so that you guys can go to these different pages and stuff if you're interested and actually read these things for yourself. Because I'm not going to sit here and read everything. But I want you guys to obviously not just take my word for it and just kind of do your own research as well. But I think in this conversation, another thing that I think was important to do here is actually define what these two things are, right? Because I do think really having a good understanding of what empathy and sympathy are is something that is necessary if we want to be emotionally intelligent. And the reason I encourage emotional intelligence is because that is a way that we can have healthier relationships. And I think that's something that's kind of missing from this conversation. Unfortunately, I don't think a lot of these men really have emotional intelligence. So when we're trying to understand the concepts of sympathy and empathy, I think it's important, like I said, to look these things up. And I found like this great article, which I will share in the notes, where they kind of help define these two different terms. And so medicine.net.com was the website. Obviously, there's a lot of great ones out there. I just wanted to find something that explained it in layman's terms, essentially. But when they say, okay, what is empathy? Basically, they kind of highlight how if someone passes away, usually being sympathetic, you will probably say like, you know, I hear you. I understand what you're feeling. But they highlight the thing with sympathy is that you're mainly kind of observing something or you're accepting what they're going through. Sympathy can also amount to feeling sorry for someone. And they say like sympathy is basically that you're feeling with them instead of deeply feeling for them. And so with sympathy, obviously, there's just kind of like a natural detachment from the situation. And let's pause there because I think understanding that detachment piece is important. From here, let's go on to define empathy. And so with empathy, they're saying that the difference is that when you're trying to be empathetic, you often try to imagine yourself in that other person's shoes. So instead of with sympathy, you're just feeling sorry for someone's loss. When you're being empathetic, you end up experiencing a fraction of their emotions and feelings, especially after seeing the things from their perspectives. And so with empathy, you end up being more open to like actively listening, asking questions, coming up with solutions. At the end of the day, empathy is often tends to be a lot better because you are essentially putting yourself in that person's situation, sharing the emotional burden with that person, and then you're also trying to come up with solutions and helping them, which all are good things and all are ultimately what we're called to do as Christians. So when we get back to this man's understanding of empathy, it's very telling and interesting that instead of him seeing it as a way to get to know people on a deeper level, trying to imagine what people feel like and using it as a way to, you know, come up with solutions like this definition says, Instead, he's worried about hierarchy. He's worried about power. He's worried about the fact that, in a way, like, I don't know, he's insinuating that we're coddling people who are victims and people that are hurting, that are asking you to empathize with them. And I do think it's also interesting with this argument, because there's another pastor that I, as I was reading, he kind of said some bullshit too, but his name is James White. And I guess he's a pastor from Arizona, and he leads Alpha and Omega Ministries, which is a Christian apologetics organization that's based in Phoenix. And he's a professor. All very alarming titles, Devin. He's a pastor, like I said. And so he also kind of echoes some of the sentiments of this first guy, Rigney, where he kind of writes in the post, he said, "So what's the problem with empathy today? We are in fact told to weep with those who weep, but that assumes those who weep have a reason for weeping that is in line with God's revelation. We are not to weep with the drug dealer who accidentally drops his stash down the storm drain in New York City. We are not to weep with the bank robber who botches the job and ends up in the slammer. We are plainly to exercise control even in our sympathy. We are not to sympathize with sin, nor are we to sympathize with rebellion or evil. But the new cultural orthodoxy is telling everybody, you shall empathize." And then, I guess somewhere in his article, he adds in all caps, "You shall not make judgments about said emotions. By doing so, you shall validate all human experiences as supreme. It has become unfashionable today to declare that someone's emotions are a result of sinful rebellion against God, and hence do not require my validation, support, or celebration." Again, a lot to unpack. But so basically my reasoning for bringing this empathy of sin up is, first of all, it's very fascinating that these white men are highlighting why we shouldn't be, you know, empathizing. And there's a, you know, culture of coddling, obviously, happening in our church. And they're saying that we need to challenge that, blah, 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 blah. You know, especially for me, being a Christian, being a woman, being Black, and also being an immigrant, it's just interesting to see how, you know, in this white supremacist culture, there's this thing that we're oppressing women, we're oppressing Black people, we're oppressing immigrants. There's been a lot of different accusations of rape and molestation and all the stuff that's been happening in the church. And of course, there's silence there, right? And there's so many things that are happening. And I think for the people that have been victims and the people that have experienced it, a lot of people have seen coddling happening for those things that are inherently evil. And a lot of the times the church leaders or these church leaders are obviously not saying much about it. But the thing that they chose to highlight in their argument against empathy being a sin, they're not mad at the people that are actually doing the shitty stuff. They're mad at the people that are getting shitted on and trying to call it out. And so for me, that's where I find that there's this a big disconnect in this conversation, because I understand if you're saying empathy being a sin, being an issue of these are people that are doing really horrible things and we're empathizing with them instead of calling them out. Great, I'm with you. But the fact that you're using this to discredit the cries of people that have actually been hurt by the church culture and the church doctrines that you guys are peddling, what are we doing? And so I think that's why I thought this argument was so interesting and needed to be talked about and explored, because I think what these men are kind of alluding to is there's this fear of vulnerability, this fear of accountability that the church has. And instead of them sitting down and thinking about it, reflecting on that, and being honest with themselves with it, they're instead writing bullshit like this, trying to gaslight us, trying to discredit the cries of people that are actually have valid points, that actually have been hurt by the church. And so for me, I find that obviously disgusting. And so I think it's so important for us to ask questions about leadership like this and challenge leadership like this, especially because as I was even reflecting on the words of the pastor, James White, he started his thing by saying, we are in fact told to weep with those who weep, but that assumes those who weep have a reason for weeping that is in line with God's revelation. And so, first of all, I was cackling because that first line about weeping with those who weep is actually biblical. It's not that deconstructionists or people that are have been hurt by the church and calling it out are creating this idea of weeping with those who weep out of the thin air. This is actually biblical. If you look in the Bible in Romans 12 in the ESV version, it's highlighting what is the mark of the true Christian. That's kind of like the title of this section, right? And so in the verses 9 through 21, he goes through what it means to be a good Christian. And he's talking about, you know, be genuine in your love, abhor or have a really big disgust or hatred for what is evil. Hold fast to what is good. He later goes in and talking about weeping with those who weep, rejoicing with those who rejoice. There's no caveat for why are these people weeping? There's no caveat that says, like, you can only weep with people if they're weeping for good reasons, right? And so that in itself was, you know, it's something to think about. And then I would say for me too, as a person who is a social worker, yes, you know, I would love my clients to not have issues with addiction or have issues with housing or whatever, or have a crime sheet, like a rap sheet, I guess, to their name. And I would love them to not be stealers and robbers. But also, I think the thing that people miss with empathy is empathy asks you to ask not what can we do to lock these people up or what can we do to punish them. Empathy is asking us to take time to ask, why are people making these decisions? Why are they choosing to sell drugs? Why are they choosing to even sell themselves? Why are they choosing to rob banks? Why are they choosing to do blah, blah, blah? And a lot of the times, if you actually sit down and put yourself in their positions and put yourself in their shoes, you will see that a lot of people, they're not choosing these things because it's like their first resort. A lot of them are choosing these things because it is their last resort. A lot of people also have history of trauma. A lot of people have generational trauma that they're working through. A lot of people, you know, don't have safe spaces where they can be themselves. And there's a lot of reasons why people choose to do things that we're not always going to understand. And I know for me as a social worker, me learning how to empathize with them helps me not only care about my patients more, but also be willing to sit with them and come up with solutions, even if I don't agree with all of the things that they're doing, right? Even with myself this past week, I was working with this young lady that's in her, you know, mid-20s. She's been making really bad decisions around drugs and alcohol. Her parents wanted her to go to treatment. She didn't want to do it, blah, 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 blah. As I sat down with her, I took some time and I was like, okay, what's going on? What are you feeling? I was sitting there empathizing with her, asking her questions, kind of seeing where she was coming from. And let me tell you, it was hard because this was a 20-something year old white woman from Texas who I could tell their family had some money, even because of the fact that she got shipped over here from Texas to go to a treatment program that costs like 30 grand. So of course, if I was looking at this woman like these pastors, I could have been like, fuck this girl. Like, you know what I mean? Like, why am I going to sit here and sympathize with her? Because obviously she likes to sin and obviously this and that, right? But because I took a minute and I was like, let me actually figure out what was going on. And she shared with me, like, you know, she was a victim of sexual assault and it happened several times. She had a person that passed away this year that, you know, there was things in her life that happened to her that were not her fault, that were guiding some of the decisions that she was making because she was in pain. And so I think that's what we miss when we're so quick to be like, empathy is a sin, and we don't take the time to really understand what is going on with people. We lose our opportunity to really be a helper to them and really guide them in a direction that's going to, you know, bring them to freedom, essentially, right? And so I think that's something that these pastors and these shepherds of churches are missing, because they're so caught up in, I can't be vulnerable, I can't be soft, I don't want my authority to be challenged, right? They're so caught up in that mindset that they're completely missing what it means to be a Christian and what it means to love others. And at the very least, again, to quote Romans, you know, Paul does end this little section about being a good Christian in verses 17 down. He talks about, like, don't repay evil with evil. Do what's good and honorable. Whenever you can, live peaceably with all, you know. And then he also highlights, like, at the end of the day, if judgment and wrath has to come, it's not up to us to do that. It's up to us to do the best that we can to overcome evil by doing good. So even, let's say, you know, these church leaders were right and people are doing evil, it's still not even our jobs to try to be evil back. That's not the point of why we're here. So again, this conversation, I mean, we could be here for hours on why this is wrong, but I just thought that, again, this is rich coming from a community, especially these white men who over and over again are showing us how difficult it is for them to, like, have vulnerability and have the sense of accountability and actually stop and sit and reflect and say, hey, maybe we're not doing this right. Maybe we're struggling. And so I hope that with time, like, we can really avoid ourselves of these bullshit concepts and be honest and maybe say, like, hey, I don't know how to love people fearlessly. I don't know how to be vulnerable. I don't know how to step into accountability. I don't know how to, you know, let go of my power. I would respect that more than this bullshit article about empathy being a sin. And I'm sure the rest of the world would too. So with that said, I do want to get into the actual, you know, book that I'm going to be doing today. But I hope you all take some time to kind of, like, read this for yourself, like I said, and reflect on it. But I just thought it was a very interesting take on, or a very interesting reaction to people saying, hey, the church has hurt me and we want some accountability to happen. To end, I think it was cool that there was a therapist named Shane Moe who basically highlights the fact that, you know, all of the stuff that's coming up in this conversation is just highlighting again, like, there's this fear of vulnerability. And so I think something that's cool that he states in an article that, again, I will post, he kind of says, these advocates appear to assume that empathy inherently makes one untethered, that one can't experience empathy towards someone else without losing oneself, getting hijacked, or sort of becoming the other in belief or practice. That is not true. Yes, allowing ourselves to experience empathy can make us more vulnerable to the influence of those who think differently than we do. And if one lives in a perpetual state of spiritual hypervigilance or fear of potentially being wrong or corrupted, and thus with deep-seated existential anxiety around theological/ideological difference and change, one might consequently come to see empathy as a threat. For the sake of not reading this whole thing, he does add that such threats obviously kind of force us to create, you know, some kind of defense mechanism to kind of protect ourselves from the things that empathy and vulnerability often involve. But if you are a person that knows how to have healthy boundaries and you try to practice those things, it is possible to be empathetic without having to compromise who you are basically as a person. And I think it's important that he kind of ends his section or part of this section by saying that if someone is saying that you can't experience empathy without being compromised by another person, there's a good chance that they're projecting out of their own psychosocial emotional boundary deficits, lack of emotional intelligence, or absence of self-differentiation. And obviously, you know, a lot of people, if you're not in the therapy world, you don't know what self-differentiation is. But basically, self-differentiation means that you come to a place where you're able to like process and identify your own thoughts and feelings and distinguish them from other people. So by doing that, you're able to hold deep connections with others and hold different views of other people without losing who you are as a person. And I will add that I think the part that's scary about the process of self-differentiation is that if you are a person that your ideologies and your ideals is wrapped up in white supremacy, hierarchy, power, you know, all the things that kind of are associated with Western American culture, I think the idea of having to process other people's thoughts and feelings might be scary to you, because we're often taught that people presenting us with other thoughts and ideas will change how we view things. But I think that is because the people that have created these systems and these powers, they know the more you're educated and the more that you understand and the more you're wrestling with these ideas, you might not hold on to their bullshit as hard as you do. And so I say that as a person that growing up in the Christian faith, again, I was scared into, oh, you have to be careful in what you're reading. You have to be careful in who you're listening to, blah, 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 blah. But when I actually went to college and I took the time to try to understand like history and all these different concepts, slowly I started to see that the reason that these people use these fear tactics weren't necessarily to protect me, but it was more so to protect their ideals and protect the things that they thought I needed to hold on to. And a lot of it was toxic. So with that, let's dive into this book. So as I stated briefly when I started this episode, we're going to be diving into this book called God Space, where spiritual conversations happen naturally. And this book is a book that was created by a man named Doug Pollack. And briefly, the reason that I decided to pick up this book was because in the past, I was very heavily involved with this organization called CREW, which was formerly the Campus Crusade for Christ. And as I was involved in this community, I was a student leader, worship leader for a bit. And this book was recommended to me. And at first, you know, I was like, eh, sure, whatever. But because I like to read, I ended up picking up this book, buying it. And I found it very helpful to kind of help guide my understanding of like how we can evangelize in a way that isn't always as toxic. At least that's what I took away from this book, because oftentimes I think, at least when we're associating the terms apologetics and just evangelizing in general, I think there's a lot of the times people do more listening to respond and listening to just make their points and not really listening to understand the person or value the person. And so I think even though there's some things in this book that I was kind of like, eh, I think if you, you know, kind of do the thing of like taking the meat and throwing out the bones with this book, there's some things in here that kind of presented that I was like, hey, this is actually really cool. And so I ended up using it as a teaching tool when I led some CREW meetings one summer. So I hope that this book can be kind of helpful for some of you all. And again, whether you're a Christian or not, I think this book did have some tools in here that I think is good when you think about how do you connect with people in a way that's authentic. And of course, we'll dive into that in a second. So for, like I promised, I will give a little intro to the book. And again, I'm not going to go that deep into reading like what the book is about. I'll just read the back. But essentially, God Space, in this book, Doug Pollack shows you how the Holy Spirit can do amazing things through everyday, ordinary conversations. You'll find fresh insights, practical tools for connecting with others when you read about the real life stories of how ordinary people learn to engage others in rich spiritual dialogue that open doors instead of slamming them shut. So they basically invite us to let Doug Pollock show you how to be a natural voice for the way of Christ. And again, I do understand for those of you who aren't Christians, that part, yikes, is probably how you're feeling, and that's fine. But I think, again, ultimately, I think this book has some good nuggets because a lot of us who, especially those of us who are adults, alarmingly, there's a lot of people that have a hard time with how to actually communicate with other people when it's not because you want to get something out of it. And again, I think this book does a good job of kind of giving a little bit of tools on how to do that, right? And so just to give a little background on Doug Pollock has an undergraduate degree from Kent State University. He also has graduate degrees from Miami of Ohio and Columbia International University. He's an author, a speaker, a reflective practitioner whose focus is to help Christ followers worldwide increase the quality and quantity of their spiritual conversation in practical, doable, and authentic ways. Since 1983, Doug's ministry with Athletes in Action has taken him to 39 different countries, 6 of our 7 continents, and throughout most of the United States to share God's never-ending changing message with an ever-changing world. In his 2 books, Irresistible Evangelicalism and God Space, in combination with his outwardly focused workshop, have opened up doors for Doug to speak in faith communities worldwide. So he is a frequent speaker at regional and national conferences around the U.S. He has had privileges of speaking at the Pentagon's Prayer Breakfast in Washington, D.C., the National Staff Conferences for Campus Crusade for Christ, or CRU, in the U.S., Canada, Moldova, and Poland. And he's done 2 national speaking tours in New Zealand. So basically, this man gets around, travels, and he allows people to kind of talk to him and share with him their experiences of having conversations with people, specifically about God in this case. And then he also shares tools and different things to help them do better, essentially. So similar to the Deconstructionist Playbook, I think before diving into the content of this book, it's important to kind of highlight how does Doug define God's space? What the hell is God's space? And in the book, in the first few pages, he kind of gives us a definition. It's pretty long, so I'm just going to highlight the ones that kind of stood out to me because I thought they were really important. But for Doug, like I said, he gives a different definitions for what is felt when you're in the God space, right? But the ones that stood out to me is God space is kind of where God is felt and encountered in tangible ways that address the longing and cries of the heart. That was one. Another one is God space is where gentleness and respect are present, judgment is absent, and divine dialogue flows naturally because trust has been established. That was another one. Another way that he defined it is God's space is a space where the topic of God can be explored freely without agendas, biases, and personal convictions getting in the way. God's space is a space where cynics, skeptics, scoffers, and spiritually curious people alike can raise their questions, share their doubts, voice their concerns, and even vent their anger towards God and the church. And lastly, another one that I really, really like is God's space is the space where the unworthy can feel safe enough to bring their real selves out into the light, into the journey, one step at a time towards the magnetic pole they sense deep in their souls. And so, again, there's a big paragraph of how he defines God's space in different ways that are really good, and a lot of them resonated with me. But I think the thing that is highlighted here is that essentially God's space should be a place that's spiritually healing for everybody, whether you go to church or not. And I think oftentimes, you know, most of the people that I've interacted with, whether Christian or not, you know, they often express to me concerns that they don't always get to feel like they can be their truly authentic selves when they're talking to people about God. And I know for me, I've been in ministry since I was in like middle school, high school. So let's say if the earliest date for me could have been like 13, I'm 31 now, right? So it's been a while since I've been in ministry spaces. And oftentimes the things that Doug has defined here as a God space, I know whether it was me or somebody that I know, we didn't always feel these things. We didn't always feel a tangible sense of God, like he said, or encountering with God, or a space where we can fully explore God without agendas or biases was another one that spoke to me. And I think that is why we're at a place that we're at right now where people are deconstructing. And a lot of people, sadly, are feeling that, you know, being outside of the church space is a space where they can actually explore God and explore who they are with God rather than within the church. And for me, I've always thought that as something that's incredibly alarming, especially given the fact that, you know, church is supposed to be a place where we can come together and ask questions. You know, instead, I think oftentimes we feel like it's a place where we have to like hide who we are, hide what we're really going through, continue the status quo, and feel like we're being oppressed and all that stuff. So I think, you know, the idea that Doug has for what God spaces can be like is so beautiful. And I think that's part of why I was initially drawn to the ideas in this book. And I still have, you know, I still am kind of drawn to some of the ideas in this book. But unfortunately, I know when we look at the ideas in the books versus the actions of what's actually going on, those things don't always connect. And so from there, after Doug kind of defines God's space, he takes a minute to kind of let us know what his main objective is. And basically, his objective is to kind of give us some tools and practical tools on how do we naturally create rooms for spiritual conversations in our daily lives. And again, if you're a Christian, obviously we're encouraged oftentimes to do that in general, just to share about Jesus, right? But I do think because we all have some kind of spiritual component to us, whether you're like the most zealous version of your faith or you're not really fucking with it like that, we do have to know how to engage with each other in conversations about spirituality and faith with respect and dignity for where the person is at, right? And so that's why I really like the idea of this book, especially again, coming from a Christian context where it felt like a lot of the times when we were engaging in conversations about spirituality, it was only really about winning people over to the faith and not really listening to them. And so even though obviously, I don't know for those of you who are familiar with the crew model or not, unfortunately, there's still going to be those people out there who basically, you know, try to have conversations about the faith only with the motive of changing people's minds to their faith. And they do it in such harmful ways. And I mean, we don't have time to really dive into that. But unfortunately, there's still going to be people that do that stuff. But at the end of the day, I think it's very important for us to do what we can to challenge it when we do see it. So I think the question is now, how do we do that, right? How can we, like Doug points out, how can we naturally create rooms to have spiritual conversations with people that can actually be life-giving and not draining, exhausting, all the other things that are, you know, negative that usually come from this, right? And so I think it's really cool that he kind of begins the book by highlighting something that a lot of Christians do that's makes it hard for people to really want to engage them with spiritual conversations. And he does this by talking about these two people named Paul and Lisa, right? And so essentially these two people became believers. And so they were really excited. They wanted to tell people about Jesus and all that stuff. And they really believed that they were going to save their family's lives. And when they went back to, you know, home for the holidays, obviously they want to talk about their faith. And as they're trying to do that, He talks about Lisa's younger sister, Karen, who essentially started getting involved in like a new age religion, and she was very excited about it, and she wanted to talk to them about this spiritual experience that she had in her dream. And instead of Paul and Lisa really sitting down and talking to her about it and listening to her point of view, they quickly, you know, cut her off and hijacked the conversation and started talking about how, you know, obviously like the devil can masquerade themselves in dreams and all this stuff. And so the point that Doug makes in telling the story is essentially that a lot of the times as Christians, instead of us taking the time to actually listen to where other people are coming from, we kind of listen to the point where we feel like we can jump in and interject, and then we totally take the conversation and make that about us. And so in doing that, we kind of eliminate the opportunity to create a safe space to have conversations about spirituality. And so I thought that was really important to, like, you know, start that conversation with, because I think at some point of our journeys, we're all guilty of doing that, whether it is about spirituality or politics or whatever. I think a lot of times we don't listen to really have a conversation. We listen so we can interject and add our point of view. So that was a great starting point, I think, for this. And then another thing I think that's important that he highlights too is that oftentimes we're not willing to meet people where they're at when we're having these spiritual conversations. And the way that Doug kind of highlights that is by his experiences of leading workshops where he was inviting people in the churches that he was working in to go to places outside of the church, like bars and other locations where, you know, the church can typically see people as like sinning, right? He invited them to go out to those different areas and say, hey, let's go engage these people in conversation. And because of the location of the bar, of them having to go to a bar, a lot of the churchgoers were like, hell no, we're not going. And so he uses that experience to highlight that a lot of the times when we are trying to engage people spiritually, we're always like, no, you have to meet me on my term, on my turf, and that's the only way I'll talk to you. And I think in that illustration, it ended up being just him and maybe a handful of people that actually were willing to go. And in his conversations with the people that were at the bar, they did end up sharing their experiences, and a lot of the commonalities were that people didn't feel invited or safe to go to these church spaces. They also didn't feel like the church was willing to actually meet them where they were at and love them and care for them and actually engage with them in the things that they were concerned about. And I think the funny part about this is that he does quote this guy named Tom Rainer, who did some research about, you know, churches and why they're dying and stuff. And I guess he called this article Seven Sins of Dying Churches. And I think it was really funny that in the survey of the churches around the USA, he found that about 95% of ministries within the church are usually only for church members alone. And so this is kind of highlighting again that because oftentimes as a church, we're so inwardly focused and we don't actually make space to care for other people in the way that we should, or create safe spaces for other people in the way that we should, obviously the church is dying. So, but I don't think, I mean, if you open your eyes and look outside, I think we all can kind of see that. So, but I did think it was interesting that Doug Pollack brought this up in his book, which was like copywritten in 2009, at least in the version that I have. And so, yeah, so from there, he kind of goes on to kind of talk about, you know, not only that we have to make the first move, but we also have to be willing to be uncomfortable and kind of step outside of ourselves sometimes and just trust our gut and talk to people. And a way that he illustrates this is what he calls the airplane story. With this airplane story, obviously, he's talking about you know, actually connecting with the passenger next to you and having good conversations about spirituality. That doesn't, again, have to be about you converting them and winning them over, but kind of understanding each other. And again, having connection, which I loved. So I love that he kind of goes from the airplane story and talking about meeting people where they're at in the bars and also not cutting people off, to kind of going into different chapters where he talks about spiritual conversation killers, ways to kind of notice your way into spiritual conversations, ways that you can serve your way into spiritual conversations, ways that you can kind of listen your way into spiritual conversations, you know, how wondering can be used. And yeah, and so again, I'm not going to go through the whole book. I'm just going to start kind of talking about some of the quotes that kind of stood out to me. But I think the takeaway from this book so far to this point that I liked is the fact that Doug is kind of inviting us to not look at Christianity or having spiritual conversations as a way to, again, win or just talk for the sake of having an argument, but to really taking the time to get to know somebody. I think this is especially important when we talk about serving our way into spiritual conversations, because I think a lot of the times the church can be guilty of, oh, let's have like a food kitchen, let's have, you know, some kind of outreach event or whatever. And the heart of the outreach event can sometimes be more so about getting people to come to the church instead of actually getting to know the community and loving the community. And that's not all churches, but I think there's enough of the churches out there that are doing that, that obviously that's concerning. So from here, let's kind of dive into this chapter that I really thought was really good that he invited us to reflect on. And that is the chapter of spiritual conversation killers. Obviously, he had about 10 of them in this chapter. But, and obviously I'm not going to go through all of them, but some of the ones that really stood out to me were pre-conversation history, using our language and not theirs, disrespect, agendas, control, judgment, combativeness, and it's all about me. And I think a lot of us, a lot of you who are listening to this podcast are probably like, yeah, I've experienced at least one of these. But the reason why these stood out to me is because I know, like, every time I've had a conversation with somebody that's not of the faith, at least one of these things come up. And so the first one that I mentioned, the pre-conversation history, I think it was interesting that he highlights how a lot of the times when we have a conversation with non-Christians, especially, a lot of them, you know, kind of assume right off the bat that you are very conservative, anti-gay, anti-choice, angry, violent, illogical, empire builders, you name it. And so, I mean, of course, when I read this, I was like, yes. But he was saying that a lot of the times, a part of when we're having these conversations with people about spirituality is we kind of have to work on getting out of this Christian box, like, as quickly as possible. And then he kind of talks about some of his experiences with, like, doing that, what that looked like. Because he obviously says that we cannot ignore people's, like, pre-conversation histories with people that are Christians if we hope to actually increase the quality and quantity of our spiritual conversations. And so I remember the first time I read this, I was like, yes, because I think a lot of the times when we talk about engaging people that are not in the church, I mean, we even saw with the idea that I presented in the beginning of this podcast, the empathy of sin, the assumption often is that people don't want to engage with us because they're happy in their sin and they don't want to change, or they don't want to be challenged to be better moral people, and that means jumping into Christianity, blah, blah, blah. But a lot of the times, a majority of the time, I would almost venture to say almost 95% of the time, people don't want to engage with Christians and Christianity. It's because they've had an experience with a Christian that was, you know, scarring, traumatic, you name it. And so if you're not willing to have an honest conversation that something like that could have happened to them and validate it and empathize with them, you've already lost the ability to have any kind of spiritual conversation with anybody. And so I say this to being a person that I am often in spaces, especially as a social worker, with people who believe vastly different things than I do. And oftentimes, again, when I'm engaging with them with my spirituality and letting them know things that I believe and they know I'm a Christian, a lot of the times their sadness or their concerns or their fears about engaging in the church has nothing to do with the teaching of Christ specifically. It usually has to do with the people. And I know that a lot of the times people don't want to be accountable and wrestle with that, but it's the truth. And especially when we look at history and how from the Crusades to, you know, colonialism, to the fact that right now most of you don't even want to wear a fucking mask because, oh, it's my Christian right. Whatever. The reality is that there's a lot of people out there that don't identify as Christian that are way more willing to be kind and generous than people that are, especially in the United States, that identify as Christian are not willing to do those things, right? And so that is something that as a Christian, I have to encounter and unpack with the people I'm talking to and be honest about and not get triggered by or be defensive about and just be like, yeah, that's it. Yeah, you're not lying, you know, and coming to an understanding. And again, like, I know for a lot of Christians, you know, having that conversation in terms of being accountable and actually acknowledging the wrongs of being vulnerable enough to say that, you know, yes, this is happening and I'm not doing anything about it or I don't know what to do about it. Instead of doing that, I think oftentimes we do what the two authors did and in the first part of this episode and just demonize other people instead of dealing with it. And so I did like how in this book, Doug kind of acknowledges that we have to understand that people are going to have their history with the church that might be negative, and we have to be willing to validate and acknowledge that no matter how we feel about it or no matter what we've experienced with it. Because I think we often are really quick to say, oh, well, that wasn't my experience. And we, again, invalidate what people are feeling, and that's not right. And then from there, I think it's cool that he also points out that a lot of the times we're guilty of using language that's associated with the Christian faith to have conversations with people instead of talking to them like they're regular human beings and meeting them where they're at. And honestly, I don't think that's just a Christian thing, like, because I know in social work and psychology, there's times that we are using words that are associated with our fields and that we talk to each other about, and we forget that, for example, self-differentiation, that's not a word that everyday people are using and understand. And so we have to be willing to either not use that language, or if we do need to use that language because it fits, define it for people. So that's important. And then obviously disrespect. I think a lot of us in our experiences with Christians, even myself who's been in the Christian faith, oftentimes I think when we think about the people that we've encountered, we do think about the fact that we feel disrespected by them oftentimes because they can be very condescending when they're talking to us about the faith. And obviously that's a really big spiritual killer. And I think, you know, the last ones that I mentioned, which were agendas, control, and judgment, and combativeness, are obviously, again, no-brainers. Like, if you are coming to people and you want to have these conversations and you're coming with them with your biases and your preconceived notions and you're only trying to argue with them and not really listen, obviously you're not going to get anywhere. I feel like those are kind of no-brainers. But I like that he takes the time to really, you know, explain each of these points in detail. And he shows you examples of how we do that and kind of invite you to be like, okay, how can we challenge this? How can we be aware that we do this in our conversations with other people and change that. And then again, I feel like even though he is focusing here on Christianity and when you are sharing our faith, this can apply obviously to anything that we're passionate about, because I think sometimes in our passion, we end up, you know, killing the conversation with other people because we do one of these things. And so I do think this chapter was very important to kind of touch on. From there, I did kind of want to touch on another idea that kind of stood out to me from the chapter where he talks about serving your way into spiritual conversations. I thought this chapter was honest in that oftentimes, like, us caring for other people in practical ways does end up opening avenues for us to talk about our spirituality. And I don't necessarily see anything wrong with that per se. But I think one of the things that really cracked me up in this chapter is he does talk about the fact that even though, like, you know, doing good deeds is like a good way for us to kind of dive in and share the good news of our faith, he was saying that the church's purpose isn't to necessarily train up experts in social work. And I just thought that that was very interesting take, because he then goes on to say, as bad as they are, poverty, injustice, world hunger, and poor health are not life's biggest issues. Where one spends eternity is. If we lose sight of this, our service will be no different from the Peace Corps, Boy Scouts, or Habitat for Humanity. There are all fine organizations doing great things, but they aren't intentionally seeking to address mankind's greatest need by offering God's greatest gift to unworthy recipients, which include us. This is why we must bring the whole gospel to the whole person. If we don't, church history will simply record one more example of what happens when the pendulum swings from an overemphasis on words to an overemphasis on deeds and then back again. I don't think God ever intended for good deeds and good news to be an either-or proposition. Okay, and so I had several thoughts on this, and especially given that I, you know, came from this church background, I think old Neff would have been like, yeah, of course, like, our salvation is the biggest thing. But current Neff was just, I read this again and I was just like, Jesus. Because I think the part that really stood out to me is that I felt that there was some minimizing of how bad poverty, injustice, and all these other things that he mentioned, like how bad they are, he minimized that. And he says instead, eternity is the bigger thing. And I think for me, being a person that's a member of a group of people that experiences injustice, I just am like, wow, that is very disrespectful, actually, and very undermining. Which I know disrespect actually was one of his conversation killers. And so I think this section was something that kind of took me back a little bit. And I was like, wow. And then I think for me, even as I move past the wow, my reaction to that was that oftentimes if you are dealing with poverty, injustice, and everything like that, you don't have time to reflect on spirituality sometimes or your mental health, any of that stuff, because your main concern a lot of the times is just surviving. And I do say that because one of the things that me and one of my close friends have talked about recently, because we're both Black women, is the fact that because in our family history, the generations before us, all they were doing were surviving, they don't always have the privilege to sit down and take a break and go to therapy and do internal work in the way that me and her have been able to do. Because in our current generation of things, We don't have to hustle that much because our family has done that. We don't have to worry as much because our family had done that in the past. And so now we're in a space where we can really be reflective and explore other faiths if we want to, go to therapy, do jobs that we actually love and not jobs that we have to do because we're stuck caring for our families in ways that is not really suitable. Like, for example, if if you're a person that is caught in a trap of generational poverty, until those things are alleviated, sometimes you're not going to take the time to think about your emotional or spiritual well-being, because again, all you're doing is trying to survive. And again, that's not saying that's everybody's situation, because some people, you know, can be in this generational poverty, but then they're also like really big faith people. I'm not saying those things have to be, you know, mutually exclusive, I guess. But what I'm really hitting at is how important it is for us to not, you know, elevate one thing over the other. And I think that's what we do as humans. We make things more important than the other type of thing. So again, the fact that he was saying, you know, you figuring out if you're a Christian or not takes precedent over all that stuff, especially if they're not really creating a space for growth and development or spiritual flourishing or anything, was alarming to me. And I do get that his take is probably a critique on the social gospel, which, you know, if you look it up on Wikipedia, the social gospel is basically a movement in Protestantism where people were starting to kind of apply Christian ethics to social problems, especially social issues like social justice, such as economic inequality, poverty, alcoholism, crime, racial tensions, unclean environment, child labor, you name it. So like ultimately people were saying, our Christian faith is saying love, justice, etc. How can we apply that to actually dealing with these issues? And that was essentially the social gospel. And so I know that, you know, in Protestantism, if you talk about the social gospel, if you talk about liberation theology, a lot of these, especially white Christian men, you know, they'll go back to, oh, it's a sin of empathy, or we shouldn't do that. The gospel is more important. But I think they don't realize what in saying that shit, that they're really undermining people's real lived experiences, and they're stopping opportunities to actually be a Christian and show up for people like we're actually called to do. And for me, I always think about in the book of Acts, I think it was like the first or second chapter, the people in the book, they sold their possessions and they did all the things that they can to help each other in their community. And I know now today we would look at that as socialism and Marxism and whatever, but that's what they did. Like that was, you know, they recognized when people had needs and they did what they can to help meet those needs if they could, you know? And so I'm always saddened by the fact that, especially in American Christianity, we try so hard to veer from that. And then lastly, just to end my point on this, I just didn't like that he came for social work, because social work, as I know it, you know, we try to promote social change and development for people, but in a good way, because if you are able to understand, you know, how humans develop and why their behaviors are the way that they are and how, you know, we kind of interact with the different, you know, cultural institutions and things that we have in place, especially in our society, it helps us come up with better strategies to do something about these things. So I don't know. I think that if the church actually wants to do what, you know, we say that we want to do, and that's love God and love others, we shouldn't be afraid to look at, you know, doing social justice work, doing social work, as we want to call it. Because I know for me, one of the things that I am adamant about, and I will say it with all of my chest, is that I don't think social work would be a thing if the church was actually doing what the fuck they were saying that they wanted to do. If we were actually loving people, if we were actually, you know, caring for the sick, caring for the poor, try to invest in systems that we're not oppressing us, but invest in systems that are looking out for the well-being of others. But I think because we've kind of tied the church so much into capitalism and white supremacy, we completely missed the mark with that. And I know a lot of people will, you know, have their feelings and be like, oh, you're being a socialist, and that's fine. But at the end of the day, I also see the book of Acts, because you do see right from the jump when the church started, their concerns weren't about hierarchy. Their concerns weren't about building wealth. Their concern wasn't about colonizing or all this bullshit that we care about. Instead, their concern was about selling their possessions and helping people that needed help, whether they were orphans, they were, you know, women, whoever they were, whatever they were doing, they were concerned with helping, you know, other people that needed it. And so I think my critique, at least for Doug in this section of this book, was that he needed to kind of challenge himself on that part. Because again, I think as a church, if we were more willing and committed to do social work and social justice work, we would actually see more people who are willing to at least see what the hell we're talking about when we're saying, hey, I do believe in God. I do love you. And I invite you to be in this space with me. And I say that to say, I do think a big chunk of why so many people are leaving or not interested in the church right now is because we aren't doing shit, you know? I think there's more non-Christians that are willing to work towards, like, you know, gun control, climate change concerns, recycling, caring for other people, you know, investing in government-funded programs for people who need it. Like, there's more people that are not in the church that care about helping other people and even wearing a damn mask than people in their church are. So I don't know. I hope that, you know, this man, maybe his mind has changed a little bit on this, but who knows? But that, again, was something that for me, I was like, oof, this doesn't sit well with me. And then lastly, I think one of the things that I really liked about this book was that he basically said, he says that, you know, spiritual conversations should be our ultimate motive and not our ulterior motive. He later then goes on to add that when your evangelical agenda begins to drive or dominate the conversation, however, you're taking a big risk. If the person you are conversing with is ready for that agenda, you'll be warmly embraced. If not, there is a good possibility that this will be the last spiritual conversation the two of you have. If we aren't careful, our evangelical agenda can become more about us than about them. This tends to push people away rather than attract them. Nobody enjoys feeling like a target or somebody else's spiritual project. And so I like that he does highlight this, and I think towards the end of the book, because I think, you know, there is going to be a point in your conversations where I think whether you're a Christian or not, you know, one person might dominate the conversation, but obviously, you have to be in tune about where you are and where the person is at before you decide to jump in. And so, you know, I think one of the things that does hurt a lot of our conversations with people is that instead of really being in tune with where that person is and how much we should share, we just plow through and just say a bunch of stuff. And then the person is like slowly shutting down. And because we're so caught up in our own world and what we think, we destroy any opportunity to have a conversation. And so I say this knowing, like, I mean, I've had a lot of bad experiences with like doing too much, but, you know, I would say it's been helpful that I'm interested in counseling because I can pick up on it pretty quickly, right? But the good experiences I've had, a lot of it didn't really involve me having to say that much. A lot of it was people just saw me naturally caring for them, having conversations, actually being interested in them. And after a while, as they realize, like, oh, okay, God is something that's important to Neff, there was natural conversations that would just come up about my spiritual life. And people were very open and receptive and were asking me questions. And it may have been a moment where I was dominating some of the conversation. But ultimately, it would always end with people being like open to going to church with me or open to having more conversations with me about my faith. It never really ended with them being like, oh shit, like Neff is such an asshole. She doesn't want to listen to me. She doesn't care. She's just trying to force this down my throat. You know, I can't even remember the last time that's happened, honestly. So, but again, that's because I learned over time how to not just make it about me and what I think, but really taking the time to like listen to other people and ask the right questions. And especially, you know, I've had to tell this to a few people too, like we don't do a good job of taking the moment to be like, oh, wait, so I think you're saying this. Is this what you're saying? And like, and really taking the time to understand somebody before we react, but instead we're just reactive. And before people are like, oh, no, Neff, like you're wrong, go to any social media platform and you'll see it. But, you know, as you're going through some of the posts, sometimes you honestly see that there's so many people out here now that we're not doing a great job of like actually stopping and listening to each other. We're just reacting. And I think this book, even though it has things within it that I was like, eh, I don't really like this, it does kind of invite us to kind of look at that and challenge it, which is also good. And then, so lastly, I think for me, one of the things that, I mean, there was a lot of, again, good things that I like, but I think a few areas, I will end by saying like a few areas that helped challenge me and force me to kind of see my world differently. There in chapter 6 and page 32-ish, he did remind us like, I think it's so easy for Christians to get lost in this idea of it's us versus them. And if we really believe like, you know, that, you know, God is good and Satan is somebody that's, you know, part of the world's, you know, foundation or existence or whatever, and that he's trying to steal and destroy like we've been taught, I think it's so important to remember that people that are not yet Christians, they may not be aware of that. And he does acknowledge that. He's like, you know, he says like essentially that they're not the enemy. They're just victims of the enemy. And I know, again, we all have different views of like who God is, why people are good versus evil, blah, 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 blah. But ultimately, I do think it is important to understand that, you know, people that do not think of us, they're not necessarily enemies. They're also victims of whatever our structures are, whatever the evils of this world, you know, is or are, whatever. And so for me, especially given the Christian context that I came from, I thought this was very eye-opening to not see people as targets or enemies, but see them as victims who may not know that yet, who may not experience growth yet, who may have not have learned about certain things yet, right? And again, I can acknowledge that, you know, thinking that way a little bit can be presumptuous, and that, you know, we're kind of thinking like our way is the only right way to live out faith. And I will admit that I'm a little bit more flexible about that now. But if we're living under the assumption that Christianity is the only way to salvation and whatever, I think in our hearts of wanting other people to receive salvation, we shouldn't be treating them like they're fucking enemies. And so I think that's one of the things that I like that Doug says, because he's inviting us to stop being combative, stop being disrespectful, stop hurting other people and trying to say it's in the name of God, and actually listen and see the other person like a human being, empathize with them. And so that was really, really, really good. And then I think another thing that I would say that kind of changed my way of thinking too was this idea of like going into ungodly spaces, quote unquote, because I know as a kid, it was always like, oh, like, you know, you shouldn't go to a club. You shouldn't go to, I'm trying to think what else is considered bad, because like, I'm pretty open to stuff now. But anyways, let's say clubs, right? you know, the idea like, oh, you shouldn't go to a club because that's where these sinners are and blah, 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 blah. But now I just look at it as like, okay, it's just another space that humans interact in. Just because it's not a church space doesn't mean there's something evil about it. Because even within church spaces, evil happens. And again, CC, all you people that are like, you know, molesting and using sexual abuse and doing all that stuff within the church. And then you're trying to say that the church is like a better space than outside places. You know what I mean? So I think the book kind of reminded me, you know, to challenge that and be open to meeting people wherever. So if it means like me going to like a crazy bar, a strip club, I don't know. I mean, I'm not really a fan of strip clubs, but the point is, if it means me going to places that may make me a little bit more uncomfortable to talk to people and meet them where they are, that's okay. You know, we should be open to doing that and not just making it about, if you don't come to my space, I'm not going to accept you, you know? And so I think as I read this book, it did invite me to just want to explore more of that and explore like jumping out of my comfort zone. And that's something that I hope that if you do pick up this book, you can take away some nuggets that kind of help you explore jumping out of your comfort zones as well. So yeah, so obviously, although there are some parts of this book that can kind of be a little cringy, depending on where you are in your life, I do think Doug does offer some good practical advice that can generally be applied to not only like having spiritual conversations, but also it could be applied to like how to have normal relationships with other people. And so that's kind of why I would recommend this book to people if you are willing to engage with it. And I say this knowing that, you know, again, like 31, and I'm alarmed at like how many adults my age, older, and even like, you know, maybe within like a 5 to 10 age difference, like we just don't know how to connect with each other anymore. I don't know if part of it is because of social media and the internet, and I'm not trying to be like an old woman here. I love technology, but I'm just alarmed of how many adults I meet that are like, yeah, you know, I just don't have close relationships. I don't, you know, I haven't had a close friendship. I've had even people tell me that I'm their first friend and we're like in our 30s, like their first close friend. And it's not a jab at people that just happened to be a reality, but I think we need to do better as a society of learning how to connect with people and not just on a superficial level, but really connecting with them to know them and to love them well. And so again, that's what I'm hoping that this book and other books, you know, similar to it can invite you to do, you know. And so with that, I just kind of leave you guys to reflect on, you know, what I shared in this podcast. As always, please feel free to share this episode with people that you know. Check out, you know, the book if that's something that you're interested in reading. I will make sure again to have all the links and things in the show notes and in the calendar that I have on my website. If I said something today that you want to engage with me more on, of course, you can always email me your questions or your thoughts at connect@soulsessionswithneff.com. Again, all of these things will be written in the show notes. And so with that said, thank you all so much for joining me on another episode. I hope you all enjoy, and I will see you again on the next one. Hey there, and thank you for joining me on this week's episode of Critical Reads. To find out more about me or to consume more of my content, please feel free to visit my website, soulsessionswithneff.com, where I share a variety of things, including blog posts, resource lists, and have a regularly updated calendar for this podcast. You can also follow me on Instagram and Facebook using the handle @soulsessionswithneff. While you're at it, if you really enjoy listening to Critical Reads, I encourage you to please subscribe to this show on iTunes, Google, or Spotify, and take some time to rate us on these different platforms. Your reviews will really help the show gain some visibility and also give me some much needed feedback on how the show is doing. I thank you in advance for your time and your support. And until next time, this has been Neff with some critical reads.